The cars of the future will be cleaner burning and more fuel efficient than today, and these vehicles are almost here. I'm Laura Kanoy, and coming up next on The Exchange, the next generation of cars. Last month, the big three U.S. automakers announced their cleaner burning cars will be in Northeast showrooms by this fall. The three major Japanese producers made similar promises, and Honda already has a low emissions vehicle on the market. Federal officials call the new developments a tremendous benefit for the American people and the American economy. Coming up, the technical, environmental, and political dynamics behind these new cars. Also, will people actually buy them? Stay with us for The Exchange right after the news on New Hampshire Public Radio. From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The six automakers that control 90% of the U.S. market all recently announced a new generation of cars. Starting this fall with the 1999 model year, the companies will offer cleaner burning and often more fuel-efficient vehicles. They'll be available in 12 northeastern states, from Virginia up to Maine, and in California. One company, Honda, is already selling its low-emission vehicle in all 50 states and its ultra-low-emission vehicle in some states. Today in The Exchange, the technology and the politics behind these new developments. We'll also find out how the vehicles work and how expensive they might be. And we'll discuss whether Americans will actually buy them. If enough people do, there could be major environmental and health benefits, among them cleaner air and a reduced threat of global warming and acid rain. We'd like your calls this morning. The Exchange phone numbers are 1-800-892-6477. If you're calling from the Concord area, 224-8989. With us in the studio this morning is Nancy Hazard. She's Associate Director of the Northeast Sustainable Energy Association. The group sponsors the Tour du Sol electric car race, which takes place in the Northeast every spring. And Nancy, welcome.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Also talking to us today from WUOM Public Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, is Don Schrader. He's technical editor of Car and Driver magazine. Hi, Don. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Laura.
Also later on the program, we'll be talking briefly with a representative from the automobile industry. Don and then Nancy, what's behind these new releases of super efficient, low pollution vehicles? What are the forces that got us to this point?
I think we're reaching a point now in the country as we approach this big new millennium that the companies themselves and the public in general are getting more worried and insecure, I think, about our future energy usage. They're seeing people across the nation buy sport utilities in larger and larger vehicles and higher volumes. Our gasoline and petroleum usage has not really gone down. And I think even the American companies, the domestic companies, are catching on to the fact that the public is getting concerned about these issues. And it's growing as we approach the end of the decade.
You think people are concerned even though gasoline prices are so low?
Well, that's what's so ironic. Gasoline prices are lower than they've been since the 1920s was the last estimate that I heard, which is just incredible if you think about it. They're a good quarter a gallon lower than they were in 1973 before we had the first energy crisis. The quickest way to get people into more fuel-efficient vehicles would be to increase gasoline prices, but politically that's unfeasible. So the lower gas prices has a lot to do with us buying much larger vehicles right now.
Nancy Hazard, what do you think? Why are we at this point now?
Well, I'm interested to hear what Don has to say about the public being interested in this. I hope you're right, Don. I think from the political side, I like to go back a little bit in history and look at certainly the 1970s, the energy security issues that were raised with the oil embargo, and then the environmental issues and the passage of the Clean Air Act, which led to the some mandates in California and Massachusetts and New York, which dictated that the automakers should produce electric vehicles. And then also in 1993, the presidential goal, the Partnership for a New Generation of Vehicles, the goal being that the car companies produce an 80 mile per gallon vehicle by the year 2003. Now, this year, for example, or I should say last year, 1997, we're starting to see the foreign auto companies actually bring these vehicles to market. Toyota, for example, shocked everyone when, well, of course, they brought their electric vehicle on a year or two ago, but last year they announced that they're selling a hybrid electric vehicle in Japan, and that, I think, really made the auto manufacturers, certainly in this country, take notice.
And we will certainly talk in a moment about the different types of vehicles that are coming onto the market and how they work. But Don, talk a little bit more about what Nancy mentions. There were some political pressures as well on the industry, the Clean Air Act, perhaps the Kyoto Conference on Global Warming in December. How much of those factors were at play here?
I think they were very important. Kyoto really caught Detroit off its feet. I think that it's kind of funny when you went over there and looked at the show itself in Tokyo. You saw the Japanese manufacturers all, you know, climbing over each other trying to bring out something that's more green friendly, while Detroit was there displaying either some hot rods or some personal luxury cars or whatever. It was a marked difference. I think that forced Detroit to look very closely at what they were going to do for the Detroit Auto Show, which is in January, and that's one of the reasons why you began to see a higher green push in Detroit. I think the political pressures are significant. I think all the auto manufacturers, both domestic and foreign, are very worried about those pressures, and they should be, because it's an open question in the next few years as to where we have to go, and there's a lot of money involved as well.
If Don, if you could briefly explain, and Nancy chime in, why are some of these cars only available in California and the northeastern seaboard states, going up from Virginia to Maine? Why aren't they available in all the states?
Well, California, for a good many years, for many decades, has required slightly different, usually more stringent emission standards because, frankly, their state has a mess on their hands with regard to automobiles, particularly Southern California. I remember in the 60s that Southern California freeways were viewed as the marvel of the nation, and now they're a bit of a disaster. I think that California was facing a situation where they had to do something more drastic than what federal standards required, and that's where they came across their own set of standards. These standards are usually more strict. They tend to be more smog-reducing, and I think many of the more left-wing New York northeastern states, I think, also decided to adopt those standards, and for whatever reason, some of them good. I think they'll it'll be interesting to see whether or not those standards can be continued in the Northeast, like they are in California.
And when you say standards, Don, you mean standards for how much stuff, emissions, can come out of the tailpipe of a car.
Exactly.
Nancy?
Yeah, just to add something to that, what California really did is they defined different types of vehicles, and I think this is really important because it's helping us, and Laura, you mentioned also the low emission or the national low emission vehicles. So they defined what comes out of the tailpipe, and they defined a low emission vehicle, a ultra low emission vehicle, and a zero emission vehicle. And the only zero emission vehicle at the moment anyway is considered the electric vehicle, although of course the proponents advocates of that, also point out that there are emissions, of course, from the utility companies that produce the electricity for those vehicles. But in any case, what the California did and what New York and Massachusetts adopted is that the car companies are actually required to produce a certain percentage of the vehicles that they put on the sales lots to be electric, for example. So originally in 1998, it was 2%. Now that's been put off in California.
Right, 1998 is here.
It's still being debated in New York, actually, as we speak, and we should hear results on that in the next couple of weeks, probably. But still, even in California, the goal of 2003 that the auto manufacturers must put 10% of the vehicles on the sales lots in California must be electric, that still stands at the moment.
And that raises the next big question that we have to discuss. You know, it's one thing for regulators in the states and federal government to say X percent of cars on the market must be low emission or electric or whatever. But Don, you know, if the car is there, that doesn't mean people are going to buy it.
Well, that's excuse me, Laura. That is exactly right. And That is one of the reasons why I think manufacturers and also dealer associations are really reflexively fighting this stuff tooth and nail. I think they are genuinely worried that they're going to be stuck with hordes of cars they can't sell. General Motors is a good example. They invested, you know, over $1.5 billion in their little electric vehicle, the EV1, which is a technological masterpiece. The thing is an amazing piece of work for a car. And yet they've less than 450 of them are out on the road. They expected at this point in time to have more than 3,000 or 4,000 of them out there. These are very difficult decisions that automakers are trying to make, and I don't blame them for dragging their feet on some of them. It's a very hard decision to make.
Why wouldn't people buy them, Don?
Well, I'll give you a good example. The EV1's practical range with lead-acid batteries, which is what they were introduced with, is 40 to 60 miles, maybe 70 miles if you're really being conservative with
EV,
the fuel
usage. EV means electric vehicle.
Electric vehicle for the EV1, their particular electric vehicle. There's an interesting story regarding the EV1. I'll try to be as quick as I can about it, but one of the decisions they made was on the batteries of the EV1 to be lead acids. That was the only way they could make the EV1 in volume at a profit, which is something they decided to do early on, which from a business standpoint makes sense. However, that only gives them a range of 40 to 60 miles. I think customers are aware of this. And that has forced them recently, because the EV1 hasn't sold at all, to switch to nickel metal hydride batteries, which now makes the EV1 go out at a loss from General Motors. This is how thorny these issues are. And I think range is one of the biggest problems of electric vehicles. Hybrids may begin to address that problem, but they're a few years down the road yet. And there's also a bunch of drivability issues regarding what customers are willing to buy and not buy.
Nancy, will people buy these cars? What do you think?
It's an excellent question. We've been running a public education event about electric vehicles called the NESI American True to Soul for a number of years in the Northeast. And one of our goals of running that event is to educate the public about the capabilities and availability of electric vehicles, and to in fact create that market. So I don't know if the customer is going to buy it, but I think that if the customer understands the positive implications of using that type of a vehicle, that hopefully we can create that market. It's really critical that we do that. I think that's the homework and what we need to do right now.
Although understanding and then acting on that understanding are two different things. People say they're concerned about the environment, but they still drive their Chevy Suburbans and other cars.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So
it's a major issue.
What do you think,
Laura,
Don? Yeah.
Laura, I've got one more thing to say about that. Just to give you an example of how fickle customers are and what the auto manufacturers have to deal with in bringing out these vehicles. In 1992, Honda brought out a little version of the Civic called the VX, which was a lean-burning engine. That engine got incredible gas mileage, about 41, I think, miles per gallon in the city, and even higher than that on the highway, approaching 60 miles per gallon on the highway. And the engine itself was a lean-burning engine, and I won't go into the details of that. It's not necessary. But the engine in its operation had a few minor drivability flaws that were barely discernible, but you could notice them. And it also didn't have terrific acceleration on the highway. Honda barely sold any of those. It was a car that otherwise was exactly the same as a Civic, and that was such a minor drivability issue that cut the sales down. You know, can you imagine what decision they have to make now when they're thinking about a hybrid, which may have many more drivability issues coming up, or an electric vehicle for that matter? It's not easy for these manufacturers to come out with this stuff and expect to sell it without worrying about a lot of risk.
Don, can you briefly tell us what some of these drivability issues are? You've mentioned a few, but...
Well, a good example is say for electric vehicles, General Motors EV1 and Toyota's or Honda's electric vehicle presently are only sold in Southern California and Arizona. There's a good reason for that. If you take the present electric vehicles that get anywhere between 60 and 100 miles of range, and put them up in say New York State or in the Adirondacks, that range in 10 degree below zero day would maybe drop to 10 miles. That's one drivability issue. There's another issue of where you're going to get your energy supplies, for example. General Motors has been trying to put in chargers all across Southern California with limited success. You have to be able to fill up your vehicle somewhere with electricity, and these vehicles need chargers. Lots of different issues. Drivability-wise, electric vehicles aren't too bad. Hybrids are going to have an issue with transferring power between the batteries, say, and the gasoline engine. There can be minor flaws in the way they go down the road. You can't rely on the acceleration quite as much as you used to. The thing simply doesn't behave like a gasoline car. That's another complaint. People are so specific in what they're used to now and what they're willing to put up with.
All right. Let's hear from you now. The Exchange phone numbers are 1-800-892-6477, in Concord 224-8989. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio, and today we're talking about the cars of the future, which are almost here. The six biggest automakers in the U.S., three American and three Japanese, all say they'll have cleaner burning cars on the market this fall, the 1999 model year. Some of those cars are already here. Honda has a low emission vehicle on the market. We'd like to hear from you. What is your question or thought about these cars? Would you buy a clean burning car if it wasn't too expensive? Also, tell us what you drive now and why you drive it. And are you concerned about fuel efficiency? Would a dramatic improvement in gas mileage motivate you to buy a new car? Give us a call. The Exchange phone numbers are 800-892-6477, in Concord 224-8989. Our guests this morning are Don Schrader. He's senior technical editor of Car and Driver magazine. He's talking to us from Ann Arbor, Michigan. And Nancy Hazard is with us in the studio. She's associate director of the Northeast Sustainable Energy Association. Again, the Exchange phone numbers, 800-892-6477, in Concord 224-8989. Don and Nancy, let's talk in a little bit of detail about these cars themselves. We've used different terms this morning: low emission, zero emission, hybrids, and so on. Nancy, to start off, very basic, what is a low emission vehicle? How low is low?
I'm not sure I can give you those numbers, but if I could take the opportunity to talk a little bit about the drivability issues that Don mentioned, I think the introduction of electric vehicles and hybrid electric vehicles is not going to be a dramatic, all of a sudden 2 or 5 or 10% of the market. I don't think that's going to happen, and I think that the issues certainly that Don raised are real. But before the General Motors put their EV1 on the market, they had already invested in the nickel metal hydride company Ovonic battery to increase their range, and they are now have just been advertising that they would have that vehicle on the market that would have like 160 mile driving range. So I think that that we're seeing dramatic advances in electric vehicle technology. They're happening really fast. So I think to judge on what was happening last year of how successful the sales will be in a year or two is probably is sort of jumping the gun a little bit. And the other thing that I wanted to point out is one of the complexities that people get confused about are what are the difference between an electric, a hybrid electric, or a fuel cell vehicle. And the key thing here is that all of those vehicles are using an electric motor as opposed to an internal combustion engine. And the electric motor is incredibly efficient. And just because you're using an electric motor, you have the ability to drive twice as far as on the same amount of fuel. So it's twice as efficient as any other vehicle. So the amount of energy you need to carry on your car sort of starts shrinking here. And then now we talk about how are you going to carry the energy in your car. I mean, what's your gas tank, in other words? What's going to replace the gas tank? And there's the batteries, which Don mentioned. There's also the idea of a hybrid electric vehicle where you have some kind of a fuel, fossil fuel on board, and then a fuel cell. So I think there's a number of options that are coming down the road, and I think that we need to be careful about, dismissing them. And as far as the drivability goes, I haven't driven a lot of hybrid vehicles, but I did drive the Toyota Prius recently, and there were four of us in the vehicle, and none of us, it was seamless. It was just like driving a gas car. I really couldn't tell the difference, and no one else in the car could tell the difference. We couldn't hear when the hybrid motor was on and when it was off. It was quiet. It was smooth. It just seemed like a really nice car, vehicle.
So to get the definitions out of the way, an electric car is purely running on battery.
Many people use the word that way, yes.
Mm-hmm. And then a hybrid has a battery, and then it has some fossil fuel that kicks in.
Right.
When?
Well, it depends. There's a lot of different ways of configuring that. That's a fairly complex technical issue.
Mm-hmm. Don, what about the low emissions vehicles then? How do they operate?
Well, low emissions vehicles are usually using the same technology that present regular emissions vehicles are using, except they're just more advanced. For example, the catalyst is put closer to the engine. The catalyst itself burns off excess impurities in the exhaust gases. It's put closer to the engine, so it'll light off sooner when you start the car, for example. There's closer monitoring of the engine to prevent the engine from spitting out impurities in the first place. It involves a little bit higher cost, but you can end up with smog-producing chemicals that are a lot lower coming out of the exhaust pipe. If you want to go into a little bit more on hybrids, there's two different kinds of hybrids. Generally, a parallel hybrid is one that where the engine and the battery both contribute to powering the car directly. There's another one called a series hybrid where the batteries essentially power the car going down the road, and there's a motor that's also attached to the batteries that help the batteries recharge. That's usually where you can define hybrids in two different ways. And the last thing is, yes, electric vehicles are pretty much running on batteries alone that must be recharged somewhere.
So, Don, low emissions vehicles operate like current cars, but just better?
They actually have the same drivability as current cars. They're just more sophisticated in their ability to eliminate emissions. And low-emission vehicles right now, which are coming out in California, there's transitional low-emission, low-emission, and ultra-low-emission. And low-emission vehicles in general have about a quarter of the emissions smog-producing components coming out of the exhaust pipe that the regular standard allows.
That's impressive.
Yeah, it is very impressive. Honda came out with it first, but it a couple years ago, I think they came out with their first low-emission vehicle. But the other manufacturers are starting to jump in now with these slightly higher technology vehicles to allow them to do this. What we find really frustrating, though, and we may not want to go into this at this point, though, is that in a lot of ways, I consider this kind of like going after the pinhole leaks in the Titanic. California's emissions problem and the Northeast's emission problem in general tend to be more an issue of older cars on the road spewing more pollutants. It's not these cars, the newer cars, that are causing most of the problem. And it's really frustrating to see that politically we can't go after the older cars. It's just an impossibility. And so we have to continue to take the newer cars, which are already very clean, and ratchet them down even further.
Well, I think you mentioned the issue of the older vehicles being the major cause of pollution. I've heard that is true in California. I'm not sure that's true in the Northeast. In the Northeast, we have a lot of salt on our roads, and our cars tend to die within 10 years. So it's rare that you see an older vehicle on the roads in the Northeast. Another thing about the Northeast is that we're much more densely populated than large portions of the country, which means in general, we don't travel the kind of distances they do in the Midwest or in the West Coast. So I think we're much more suited to a shorter range vehicle, such as the electric vehicle.
Let's go to the phones. Again, this is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio, and we're talking about the cars of the future today with Nancy Hazard and Don Schrader. We're going to go to your calls now. Again, The Exchange phone numbers, 800-892-6477. If you're in Concord, call us at 224-8989. Ron is up first. He's calling from Derry. Hi, Ron.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I was just wondering, what about manufacturers researching cars with alternate fuels rather than electricity? Is there been a lot of that, and are they doing that now in certain states like California?
Don, that's a great question. Ron, excuse me, it's a great question. You peeked at my script. I had the same one.
Oh, okay.
Don, what's going on? We heard a lot in the 70s about methanol and fuels from all sorts of different grains and so forth. What's going on with that?
Oh, there's been an awful lot of research into this, and there are indeed many alternate fuel vehicles out there right now. There's a number of issues that come up. For example, with methanol and ethanol put into gasoline, you bring up some drivability issues. There's also some wear issues in the cars that the manufacturers didn't anticipate. Compressed natural gas is a terrific fuel for motor vehicles, but the problem is we don't have an infrastructure in the country that allow us to use our compressed natural gas, which is really frustrating because we're blowing off an awful lot of natural gas right into the atmosphere at this point in a lot of places. So a lot of these things are born not so much, a lot of the problems and the issues surrounding alternate fuels isn't so much the cars themselves. It's, do we have the capability to deliver the fuel to the car? Is the customer going to accept some different performance issues surrounding alternate fuels? Those questions are all in the open. And as I said before, people are so used to gasoline cars performing in the manner that they expect that it's very hard to bring other fuels into the market and make them succeed.
So the infrastructure isn't there, the gas stations and so on?
It certainly isn't for compressed natural gas. And I've driven compressed natural gas cars. They drive just like normal gasoline-powered cars. But where are you going to fill them up?
Ron, you interested in an alternative fuel car?
I would be. What about, it seems to me that recharging stations would probably be more difficult to set up as an infrastructure than to just have an alternate pump at a station with a different fuel.
Nancy, what do you think?
Well, it's an interesting point. A lot of the advocates, I have to say that I'm an electric vehicle advocate, so I haven't dealt a lot with the other alternative fuels. And the reason that I'm an electric vehicle advocate is because I'm with a sustainable energy association, and so our sort of long-term vision is electric vehicles that are recharged with electricity that's produced in some renewable fashion. But most people in this country, a lot of families have two cars. And they use one car as a weekend car, they use another car as their around town or their commuter car, that type of thing. And so what the market that the electric vehicle is really aiming at this point is the vehicle, the around town vehicle, in which case you will never go to, you don't ever need to go to a gas station because you would always be charging that vehicle at home. And that's one of the advantages of it.
Ron, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye. Bye. We are going to take a very short break, but stay with us because when we come back, more detail on these developments, we'll talk with a representative from the automobile industry. Also, your phone calls. So stay right here. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. On tomorrow's show, sales and income taxes. Join us tomorrow for The Exchange.
Support for The Exchange comes from our contributing listeners and Auto Fair Manchester, New Hampshire's largest new car dealer, committed to consumer convenience. Now all 8 Auto Fair brands are located across from the Mall of New Hampshire in Manchester. And Public Service of New Hampshire, a commitment to community development and more, PSNH, supporting your life in every moment.
We're back with The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Laura Kanoy, and today we're talking about the next generation of cars. Our guests are Nancy Hazard. She's Associate Director of the Northeast Sustainable Energy Association. The group sponsors the Tour de Sol electric car race that takes place in the Northeast every spring. Also speaking to us from WUOM Public Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, is Don Schrader, Senior Technical Editor of Car and Driver Magazine. We're going to go now briefly to Washington and talk to Bob Babbitt. He's with the American Automobile Manufacturers Association. And Mr. Babbitt, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Laura. Thanks for having me on the show today.
We discussed this question early on in the show, but I'd like to hear your opinion. What's behind the move that we have seen among all the major automakers to build cleaner cars?
Well, the move, Laura, you know, sometimes it's been portrayed as it's just been recently, but the automobile manufacturers, including AMA's member companies, GM, Ford, and Chrysler, I've been working on these issues for quite some time. We've been working on alternative fuel vehicles, as has been mentioned in your show, for quite some time. And some of the newer developments, such as fuel cells and electric vehicles and hybrid vehicles, these types of technologies didn't spring up overnight. We've been working on them for quite some time. There's always been a concern to make sure we provide a car that meets our consumers' needs and also has a and limited impact on the environment. And so we've been working hard at trying to do that.
Don Schrader mentioned earlier that car companies are worried that they'll invest millions of dollars in new clean technology for cars, and then nobody will buy them. Is that a concern?
Well, it's a concern from the standpoint that we don't want to be pushed into a direction from, I guess, a regulatory standpoint to focus on a certain technology. I guess from the automobile manufacturer's standpoint, we have a lot of research and development efforts ongoing currently. We want to look at all the different alternatives that are out there, including fuel cells and hybrid vehicles, electric vehicles, and look at them all and try to see which one meets our consumers' needs, which one provides the utility and the safety that our consumers expect, and push our resources in that area. Recently, with the new program that actually was put into effect yesterday by EPA, which was the National Low Emission Vehicle Program, we made a step forward in trying to provide a consistent and a stable program and voluntarily stepping up to provide, you know, lower emission vehicles throughout the country. So I think our commitment's there, and we're showing that.
Talk about the role, Mr. Babick, that the federal and state governments, such as California, played in promoting and pushing this technology along.
Both in the California and the federal EPA have for quite some time been looking at vehicle emissions and regulating those emissions, and have tried to put forward programs in which to allow manufacturers the opportunity to look at different technologies and meet the standards that they put out. When EPA put out its Tier 1 emission standards back, I believe it was in 1994, they set very stringent emission standards that the manufacturers had to meet, and worked with us in trying to figure out ways and how to accomplish that. We work with the federal government. We work with California. And recently on the National Low Emission Program, we worked with the Ozone Transport Commission and the Northeast states on working out and hammering out all the details in that, so that we can bring this voluntary program forward to both the Northeast and the rest of the country.
Don Schrader, what do you think about this, I don't want to call it a struggle, but this sort of back and forth between, okay, if you don't regulate here, we'll do this voluntarily, all right, but we might regulate more here. What do you make of that?
I think it's a natural struggle. Auto companies are in business to make money. I don't think it's logical to expect them to do otherwise, just as it would for any other business. I don't think that means, however, that they're only in business to make money, that long-term viability is very important to any business. And I think automakers also want to do well by the communities in which they sell in. And I think that's the reason why you see this. Now, where does the government fit into this? I think sometimes government regulation isn't a bad idea at all. If you look at the safety technologies we have in many of today's cars, they're amazing compared to what they were 25, 30 years ago before all of this regulation started. So I think we have two entities that are sometimes fighting and sometimes opposed, but I think sometimes a lot of things can get done pretty effectively when they also cooperate.
Bob Babick, what do you think of that?
Well, Laura, I agree, and I think that the NLEV program is a good example of that. I mean, you have a situation back in 1993 when we proposed this, that what we were seeing was a lot of the states in the Northeast were proposing an alternative to adopting their own programs for mobile emissions. And what we saw was a potential for like a patchwork of programs being required in the Northeast. We looked at that issue and we offered an alternative and said, look, you know, we'll voluntarily step up and offer these low emission vehicles throughout the country, not just in the Northeast. And what we were looking for was, again, a stable program. I mean, when we're planning car platforms and when we're trying to engineer them so that they meet these standards, we need that stability so that we can plan for, you know, future products and provide those vehicles out there and meet these very stringent emission standards. Case in point, with like the new NLEV program, the vehicles that are going to be delivered in the Northeast just at the end of this year are going to be 70 and 50% cleaner for smog-causing hydrocarbons and nitrogen oxide. And, you know, that's quite a difference than the current federal standards. And if you look at it from a historical perspective, I mean, if you look back to pre-controlled, currently the new vehicles are 99% cleaner. And I think that's a major accomplishment that we've come a long way.
You've used the term NLEV a couple times. Remind us what that is.
Yeah, the National Low Emissions Vehicle Program, or we refer to it as NLEV, was a voluntary program that was proposed by the automakers back in 1993. I guess what makes this program so unique is the fact that it must be joined voluntarily. This is because when the 1990 Clean Air Act amendments came out, they didn't allow EPA to set more stringent national emission standards. They set standards in 1994, which sometimes you'll hear them refer to as Tier 1. And then it said that EPA would come back in 2004 and look at whether or not they needed a second tier or Tier 2 standards for vehicles, and that those if there was a need for those standards, that they would be set. What NLEV did is it identified 23 manufacturers which were allowed to sign up voluntarily to the program, and it also gave the opportunity to 12 northeastern states in the District of Columbia to opt into the program voluntarily. And using NLEV as an alternative to adopting like California type regulations, and by providing these cleaner vehicles sooner, 9 of the 13 jurisdictions in the Northeast chose to participate in the NLEV, including New Hampshire, by the way, and we applaud that. Unfortunately, Maine, Massachusetts, New York, and Vermont have still decided not to participate, but you know we're continuing to urge their support and have them join the program.
One last quick question for you, Mr. Babick. We've talked a lot this morning about emissions and having cleaner burning cars. Are the manufacturers also looking at improved gas mileage?
Yeah, Laura, we have many things going on, including we look at emissions, we look at safety issues, and we look at fuel economy issues. Our member companies, as was evidenced at the recent International Auto Show, is taking a serious look at fuel economy. We look at how to build these vehicles. When you talk about fuel economy, a lot of times you're looking at trying to make the vehicle lighter so that it doesn't require as much energy to move it down the road. So we're looking at a lot of new high-tech, lightweight materials, but these lightweight materials cannot sacrifice the integrity or the structure of the car because, you know, safety is always a concern. You don't want to make that trade-off, and what you have to do is find that happy balance. And our member companies are looking at it. We belong to a group, the PNGV program, that its goal is to produce a fuel-efficient car in the future that, it's with its target as being 80 miles per gallon. And there's a lot of time, effort, and resources being spent to bring this to reality.
All right. Well, we'll keep our eyes and ears open. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Well, thank you, Laura, and I appreciate being on today.
All right.
Thank you.
That's Bob Babick. He's director of the Vehicle Environment Department for the American Automobile Manufacturers Association. He spoke to us from Washington. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. We're talking today about the cars of the future. The new cleaner-burning cars will first be available in California and 12 eastern seaboard states from Virginia up to Maine. The six big automakers in the U.S. all say they'll have these cleaner-burning cars on the market this fall, the 1999 model year. We're going to go back to the phones now. Again, the exchange numbers are 800-892-6477. In Concord, 224-8989. The next call is from Auburn. It's Michael. Hi, Michael.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
I'm curious what is going to be the price of these vehicles, such as the EV1.
Yeah, good question.
Is there an answer?
That's an excellent question. Actually, the EV1 is being offered for lease, not for sale. And in California, with the there are some tax credits available also for electric vehicles. I believe the price is, and maybe Don, you know better than I, but I think it's about $395 a month. Is that right?
That's right, Nancy. They recently reduced it. The starting capitalized cost of the EV1 when it was first introduced was approximately $35,000. In other words, if you were to lease a car for $35,000, it would come out to about the same price as what the EV1 lease was. However, when you factor in the various tax incentives in the state and the federal government, that leasing cost was coming down to about $20,000. But that was not necessarily even a profitable proposition for General Motors, even at that price. So here you've got, you're spending $20,000 on a two-seat commuter car that can go, 60, 70 miles. It's a pretty depressing prospect.
Don, well, I'll throw out one more price here is Toyota. I've mentioned the Toyota Prius, the hybrid electric vehicle that they're selling in Japan right now. They're selling it in Japan for about $17,000, and the rumor has it that the price, they're going to introduce that in this country this year at some point, probably at a similar price. So I think we're beginning to, this is the beginning of seeing a car company really say, okay, in order to, for us to produce this vehicle and to produce it cost effectively, we need volume, and the way we're going to get volume is to offer it at a price that the consumer can afford.
That's true, Nancy. There's one more thing I'd like to add. They're only making about 1,000 of those, I think, a month, what Toyota's planning, and they're losing money on every one. I don't mean to, you know, beat a dead horse here with regard to this losing money issue, but no company yet has come out with a really advanced electric or hybrid vehicle that is making money. It's a very tough prospect.
I guess I wouldn't expect that to happen in any new product for several years, so that doesn't concern me so much.
Michael, jump back in.
Yes, now the range you talk about, is that with how many passengers on board?
Passengers don't make that much difference, it seems, at least in our own tests. We found that when driving with a lead foot in an EV1 with lead-acid batteries, you're getting about 40 miles. If you don't drive with a lead foot and drive conservatively, but you keep off the air conditioning, you'll maybe get 60 miles. Now, the nickel metal hydride batteries that they're putting in now that are much more expensive have supposedly doubled the range, so it's up over 100 miles. But that's still about it, and the present competitors from Honda aren't that much different.
All right, Michael, thanks a lot for the call. Good question.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Let's go next to Pembroke. Penty's on the air. Hi, Penty.
Hi, this is Penty. I thought I would call and first congratulate the solar, what used to be the Solar Association, for its continued existence over these many years.
Thank you.
The question I had was with the use of some of the new high, well, diesels are generally much more efficient than gasoline engines. They've always been a little bit dirtier, but apparently some of the new engines are much cleaner. And wondering what, if any, work is being done looking at use in hybrids.
Use of diesel fuel in hybrids, Penty?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's quite a bit of work actually being done on that, mostly on the bus end of things.
Mm-hmm.
Orion Bus, for example, has a diesel hybrid transit bus, a 40-foot bus that they're selling to New Jersey and New York right now. And we're seeing some other shuttle buses and other buses that are working on that issue.
Don, do you know anything about that?
I know Volkswagen has introduced a really high-technology diesel engine called the TDI that they've offered throughout their product line, and that uses a two-way catalytic converter that does reduce significantly the amount of smog and particulates that come out of smog-producing compounds and particulates that come out of the exhaust pipe. However, unfortunately, while that thing gets fantastic gas mileage, the TDI does, it's a good, I bet, 50 to 80%. Maybe 50% better than a typical gas engine in a similar sized car. Unfortunately, you also have to deal with some of the diesel hassles of finding diesel fuel and some of the noise issues. So there's a few downsides to that. And also, those are dirtier, more polluting vehicles still than gasoline-powered cars. So there's a trade-off here. It's not easy.
Penty, what do you think?
Well, I agree that they're still dirtier than they should be. I guess the question, many people are just saying just ban these things altogether. And I guess what we would do at that point is kind of shoot ourselves in the foot.
It's kind of a difficult prospect, Penty, because these things are indeed more fuel efficient than a typical gasoline engine, and they also tend to work better in big trucks.
Penty,
well,
thanks.
Even in the cars, they have improved quite a bit. I mean, I can remember driving my old Chevette and getting my 40 miles per gallon in the diesel version of it, but I could
pretty
also
amazing.
See the cloud behind me.
Yeah.
Right.
As I understand it, the new ones, as you say, with the high-tech changes in them are much... as I remember, the Passat version of the VW will get something like 50 miles per gallon on the highway and go 800 miles on a fuel fill, so...
That's right. I think it gets 41. I think it gets 41 or so in the city and over 50 in the highway. It's a very transparent car. You only hear a slightly different noise when you drive it around, and it doesn't really even smell that much. So they've made a lot of progress.
1-800-892-6477 in Concord, 224-8989. We have about 10 minutes left on the exchange to talk about the cars of the future with Nancy Hazard from the Northeast Sustainable Energy Association and Don Schrader from Car and Driver Magazine. We're going to go next to Salem, and John is calling from his car phone. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Go ahead.
I had a question regarding fuel cell technology. I've been following Ballard. I guess it's one of the fuel cell companies, and their involvement with Mercedes-Benz. And I saw some stats on their recent car, the third test car, which was very impressive from a drivability standpoint. I think they had 400 or 500 kilometer range and some good pickup numbers. And I guess they're investing in Mercedes is going to produce a number of these vehicles in the near future, along with the Ballard fuel cell, and using methanol, which seems to be something that could easily be put into service stations. And what's the limitations with this? It seems to be a little bit, I guess, on the surface, more of an advanced technology than anything I've seen in the other areas, as far as electric standpoint and easy to implement this type of fuel as well.
Nancy. Yeah, I've been following the Ballard progress as well, and it certainly looks incredibly promising. And they're looking at using it both in cars and in buses. There's a bus project that's going to start up in Chicago. I guess the first couple of buses have already been delivered using the Ballard fuel cells, and it's very exciting. And we're all sort of sitting here on the edge of our seats, waiting to see how it all pans out. There's certainly a lot of cost issues here that I think those are the things that concern me the most. Certainly from an environmental perspective, it looks terrific.
Don, the fuel cell with methanol.
Yeah, it does look pretty promising. Unfortunately, we're still a number of years away from bringing something like this out, and cost is indeed an issue. Can Mercedes-Benz get this to be cost equivalent to a gasoline engine such that it can be competitive? If it isn't, let's say it's $5,000 or $10,000 more in a $40,000 Mercedes-Benz, when it really comes time to write the check or sign the papers for the car, is the customer going to be willing to do this, knowing that essentially what they're doing is saving the environment or helping the environment? Those are open questions at this point, and something Mercedes-Benz still has yet to answer.
John, does that answer for you?
Yeah, what about the infrastructure, implementing methanol in the infrastructure of gasoline stations that we currently have?
Right.
That wouldn't be as difficult as, say, compressed natural gas, where you have to put a compressor in the service station and have some kind of a major natural gas feed. Presumably, you could use gas pumps for something like that. I mean, we presently have methanol mixtures in our gasoline offered in a number of different service stations. So it probably wouldn't be as difficult of an issue from an infrastructure standpoint as a lot of the other alternative fuels.
All right, John, thanks for the call. We have time for one or two more calls. We're going to go next to Manchester. Keith, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I just had a quick question for you. The exclusively electric or battery-driven vehicles, how long does it take to recharge them? If you go 60 or 120 miles with the newer ones, do you then need to plug them in for 2 hours a day, let's say, if you work 60 miles from home?
That's an excellent question. And I guess there's a couple of different answers to it. I guess there's never simple answers to any of these things. But you can plug them in at home and charge them overnight. That's how people think they will be used most of the time. However, depending on the battery technology that you have, a lot of the batteries are capable of doing what they call a quick charge, which usually goes between 5 and 15 minutes, and you can charge up to, let's say, 80 or 90% of the total capacity of the batteries. So one of the things they're talking about is having, let's say, what they call an opportunity charging station away from home that would enable you to do that quick charge in the middle of the day, and then at home you would probably do the slower kind of overnight charge.
Is there any?
I'm sorry. Go on.
Is there any penalty for using the quick charge? In other words, does that shorten?
No,
the life?
In fact, they thought that might be the case, but some of the batteries actually prefer it to the slower charge.
Yeah, once again, there's kind of a trade-off involved in this technology. Generally speaking, if you have a outboard charger, for example, one that you had to put into your house or the service station or a mall where you would park, generally the higher the voltage, the quicker the charge. On the other hand, though, the higher the voltage, the more expensive the charger, and also the more difficulty it is getting the power to the charger. They have ones that go up to 440 volts that will charge the car in as little as an hour or two up to maximum capacity. The question is, does a service station, for example, have a 440-volt feed to it, for example? Your house only has 220, so that limits you right there to a certain amount of charging capacity.
And with electric rates in New Hampshire, that would make people shudder. Don, you may not know this. We have among the highest electric rates, if not the highest electric rates in the country. Keith, how does all this sound to you?
Well,
as a consumer,
I was surprised that it was as short as possibly as low as 5 to 10 minutes for an 80% charge, and I think that's encouraging. Just, you know, from dealing with rechargeable batteries myself, they take a long time to charge, and I was just concerned that perhaps in driving to work and having to run some errands along the way that, you know, halfway home I'd be stuck at some, lack of a better term, gas station to plug in for 2 hours or so.
Mm. Well, that's an interesting point, but there's a lot of other points that go along with it. First of all, is your gas station going to have a charger? Mm-hmm. Second of all, is it going to have another car stuck to it? I think the big question for electric vehicles in the Northeast is, what in the world are you going to do when it's 10 degrees above zero? And
well,
these things are getting 30 miles of range. The technology
That is definitely the Achilles heel of the lead-acid battery. There's no question. But the nickel metal hydride batteries and some of the other lithium-ion batteries, et cetera, are not as affected by the cold as that lead-acid. So I think that we're going to see some of those problems go away. The other thing I wanted to say about range is that in the NESI American Tour du Sol event that we've had, again, obviously the people who are driving are experts at very light feet, but we have seen ranges of 250 and 373 miles driven on an electric vehicle. So I think the cost barrier of the battery is definitely sort of the issue here. I mean, you can put a lot of batteries in a vehicle and go far. So there has to be some balance between the cost and how far you want to go. And I think what we're going to see in the future is a mix of different kinds of vehicles out there. There'll be some electrics for people who have short distances or shorter distances or urban kinds of traveling patterns. You'll see some hybrids for people who need to go longer distances. You'll still see some other alt fuels and gasoline vehicles. So I don't think it's going to be all one or the other.
Keith, thanks. We've run out of time.
Okay. Thanks for having me on
all
the
right,
phone.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Nancy, you basically answered my last question, so I'll throw it to Don. What do you see out there in the future? We've talked about pure electric cars. We've talked about hybrids. We've talked about low-emission vehicles. We've talked about alternative fuels. Nancy's given us her vision. Don, what's yours for the next 10 years?
I think that if I were to bet on it, I would say that hybrids are probably our most viable option in the near future. Hybrids address the issue of emissions very effectively, but they also address the issue of limited range of electric vehicles. And if you had to bet on it, that's probably where I would go with it at this point. I don't think electric vehicles have the range with the cost available. And I think the gasoline engine is going to be still around in 10, 15 years, but it may be in a very different form. And boy, if we have an energy crisis, who knows?
Yeah, it'll all be up in the air. Don Schrader and Nancy Hazard, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
Nancy Hazard is Associate Director of Northeast Sustainable Energy Association. That's the group that sponsors the Tour du Sol electric car race, which takes place in the Northeast every spring. Talking to us this morning from WUOM Public Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, was Don Schrader. He's Senior Technical Editor of Car and Driver Magazine. If you have questions, comments, or ideas for the exchange, call our listener line at 603-223-2471 or email us at exchange@nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. Scott McPherson is the producer. Mary Kruger is assistant producer. Our intern is Michelle Kotler. The engineer is Ron Byron. And I'm Laura Kanoy.
If you missed part of today's program, listen anytime at www.nhpr.org or listen to The Exchange tonight at 8 p.m. following Fresh Air. Cassette copies of The Exchange are available by calling 603-228-8910.